B-Pod Studios.
Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, a man who once successfully convinced our receptionist that even par was a Swedish pop star, Charlie Nance.
Hey, welcome back. Once again, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT underscore golf guy. In the 1980s and 90s, television was populated with nighttime soap operas. Shows like Dynasty and Dallas, Knott's Landing, Melrose Place, etc. Each one of these was so over the top with unbelievability that it was hard to focus on which weekly crisis was the worst. That's the way I felt as I was watching the Northern Trust at Liberty National last week, the first leg of the PGA Tour's FedEx Cup playoffs. From Tiger's surprise withdrawal to Harold Varner III's redemptive final round to Patrick Reed successfully handing off the title of least liked player on the PGA Tour to Bryson DeChambeau, one who covers the game could hardly focus. We'll talk all this and more with Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, who was on the beat in the Big Apple last week. Also, we're going to spend a good deal of time this week talking with Tom Pashley, the president, visionary leader, and really steward of Pinehurst Resorts, side of this weekend's U.S. Amateur. But we begin with Ron Green Jr. You know, some weeks, Ron, I've been with you at PGA Tour stops, and literally I've had a conversation that went like this. Ron, where are you going right now? I have no idea what I'm going to write about. I've got to go search for a story. Last week for a writer had to be eeny, meeny, miny, mo. There was more stuff happening on the PGA Tour at one stop than soap operas have happened in like 6 months. So I'm going to take some things one at a time. Let's start with Tiger Woods. Where are we now?
Was it first time since, 2015 he had withdrawn? But it was, alarm bells went off when he announced he wasn't playing. And, looks like he's playing BMW this week. But, I think it was just one more moment in sort of this timeline that the farther we get away from what he did at Augusta in April, the more it becomes evident how special that was. And it may very well be that was the last great grand moment. Now he's come back and proven us to us that he can do things we didn't think time after time. But, obviously it's this season, instead of finishing with this great rush, it sort of dripped to a disappointing close because he just hasn't been able to make anything happen on the golf course. He didn't play particularly well the round he played up there. So, I don't know. It was, discouraging, but I think the glow of April is still just overshadows everything.
You and I, neither one, have the word physician next to our names. That being said, that doesn't stop me from speculating. How do you like this theory? Tiger Woods has proven time and time again that once he sets his mind to something, we may never have seen a more determined athlete in any sport to make something happen. His determination, his drive, and his adrenaline pumping through his body to make it happen, not just at Eastlake, but to come all the way back to prove everybody wrong and to win a major championship, carried him through some physical pain and discomfort. And once it happened, once the endorphins had been released, once his body exhaled, all of a sudden it hit him that, you know what, this hurts a hell of a lot more than I thought it did. Is that possible?
Well, sure, it's possible. I think the thing I would lean more toward is I wonder if emotionally it just drained him to where he can't restock that reservoir to where it was. I think it was such a big thing, and we've talked about it since it happened that Sunday when he won and the way he reacted and the pure joy and the kids and all those things. I think it was such a release on so many levels, but I think particularly emotionally and maybe mentally that it just – it took him to a place he wasn't sure he was ever going to get back to. And we all know if you're not fully committed or you can't quite get back to that same level, even if physically you're okay, and I think that's the best we can say is he's okay at times. I just think it's hard for him to regenerate what he had. I think, you know, to expect him to go out, and whether it's a Torrey Pines or Memorial or, you know, even a PGA Championship, it's hard to expect him to do that again. He made us think he could, and maybe he will one more time. Yeah, I don't think we've seen the end of Tiger Woods. I just think, as he keeps telling us, and all we got to do is listen, is he's not going to be that way all the time. There are going to be weeks when he's good and special, and there's going to be weeks when he's back home for dinner Friday night.
Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking dead aim. You know, some guys like Colin Morikawa and Matthew Wolf, they come right out on tour and they win immediately and away they go. And other guys, it's a progression and it's a learning experience just like it was in the old days. And I'm speaking specifically of Harold Varner III, who's, you know, come up through the minor leagues, got his PGA Tour card, held on to his tour card. This year was in the final group on Sunday at the PGA Championship. That spotlight was way too bright for him in that moment. But last week, HV3 took, I thought, some huge steps in the right direction. It was Sunday. He was in the hunt. He finished under par. And, you know, he's a couple of putts away from either being in a playoff or winning that event. Great strides for Harold Varner, yes?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the biggest, the highest finish of his PGA Tour career. I mean, you know, it jumped him from whatever, 102nd to whatever, 28th in the FedEx Cup. You got him to this weekend, just, you know, getting the BMW where there's no cut, so there's guaranteed paycheck there, plus you further enhance the payoff you're going to get in the FedEx bonus pool, and do all that with the chance to get to Eastlake, which, if he can hold on to his top 30 spot, gets him into his first ever Masters, gets him into so many other things. So, yeah, that was huge, and to do it because, you know, he was right there. And then suddenly he makes the mess of the ninth hole and makes a double bogey there, pulls his tee shot in the water, and then, you know, chops it around and makes six there and really dropped him back, I think, three back there, and turns around, makes those birdies and gave himself two great chances coming in. It was interesting. I talked to him right after the round, I mean, 5 minutes after he's finished, and, you know, and it was almost like he wasn't sure how happy to be because there was an element of frustration and disappointment that he had been that close and he hadn't won. But I think, you know, big picture, he was ecstatic about what he had done and what had, you know, he had learned about himself. I mean, he was hitting better than anybody coming down the stretch here. You know, two more of those little, what, he had a 6-footer and an 8-footer and 16,
oh, yeah.
17. And, you know, maybe it's him instead of Patrick Reed we're talking about. But still, for him, huge moment for him to get back in a position, you know, serious contention on Sunday afternoon, and how the way he did was just, and that was a Bob Beamon-esque leap for him, I think.
Thank you for bringing up Patrick Reed. He won the Masters in 2018, had all the controversy surrounding him at the Ryder Cup at around this time last year, and then has just been sort of a little boy lost in the wilderness, it seems, this entire PGA Tour season. Started listening to a bunch of different people, trying to change some things, switching clubs around, switching putters around. And then it was like all of a sudden he had an epiphany and said, you know what, I'm going to start playing like Patrick Reed again. And he's had a pretty good last couple of months. But wow, that was vintage Patrick Reed, the assassin that we saw on Sunday. And it was good to have him back.
Yeah, I mean, he did sort of go into a, I don't know if you call it a dark place, but he just lost all the things that had made him, that had separated him. And there he was. You know, he told a story that after the PGA at Bethpage, he took 2 weeks off, family vacation, rented a house out there. He was staying in the Hamptons. He said, which with a front yard, 310 yards long, 50 yards wide, perfectly manicured. He didn't hit balls there, didn't touch a golf club literally for 10 days. Played with the kids, spent time with the family, his wife and everything, and just the longest break he could, in his memory, recall, and said, you know, decided, okay, I just needed the hard reset. Went back out, started playing golf up there, so he went to National Golf Club, first round, drivable par four, pegged it up, hit it to 6 feet, made an eagle, and thought, okay, maybe this was a good idea. And so it sort of brought him back. You know, he's never been the straightest hitter out there. But we all know about his tenacity and the way he likes competition. And it's been coming. There's been, you know, the trend line has been going up. And at Greensboro last week, I talked to him a little bit about it. And he people saying, I know it's there. You hear players talking about having to be patient, waiting for the score to match up with how they're feeling, and it finally did for them.
One thing that happened was Patrick Reed and many memes on social media over the weekend passed the baton of least liked person on tour, it seems, to Bryson DeChambeau. This was the huge story coming out of the Northern Trust. There's a lot of things to get into. Let's start with the fact that I think that, in a way, Bryson's right in that everyone sort of jumped on him. It was unfortunate that he was in the featured groups on PGA Tour Live, and that's where we saw the egregious misuse of time by him, because television is partially to blame, I think, for hiding some of the slow play on tour because the editing they do, and we don't see, you know, we just see them, oh, now we're back to 17 and Bryson's ready to putt. And so we don't see the 2 minutes that took place going into that, because he's by no means, as slow as he looked, he still is a distant second to me to J.B. Holmes, whose name was barely mentioned last week. Did you think there was some unnecessary piling on and Bryson being singled out too much?
I think there, yes, in certain ways, and I think there was some regret the way from some players about the way they pounced on that. I mean, J.B. Holmes can be methodical, but I don't know that even J.B. takes. Well, okay, at Torrey Pines a couple years ago, he took as long as Bryson took that little pitch shot. But you know, there's, and Bryson tried to explain it and excuse it, and it was basically, for a guy that smart should know, that was an indefensible position there, that and the short putt, even if he's arguing how fast he gets to the ball. Yeah. I walk faster than everybody, so I'll give myself more time. Well, if you're going to take that much time, as I equated it to, it's like making a quick trip to the grocery store, buzzing in and out of the grocery store, then to get the ingredients for dinner, then being 2 hours late getting dinner on the table, you know? I mean, what good does it do you? So I think, you know, that the subject has been simmering all summer, and it simmers every year. And, you know, it kind of started with Koepka pointing to his imaginary watch over there at Port Rush. And, you know, and so there they had example 1A, 1B, all this. And, yeah, I mean, Bryson, you know, I know he had gotten advice not to talk to the media on Saturday, but he couldn't wait. I mean, he bounded up the stairs to the little podium to talk to us and defend himself. And, you know, the fact of the matter is Justin Thomas said he's slow. He said, I like him. He's fun to talk to, fun to be around, but he's a slow player. He said he's not alone. He's not the worst. But, you know, he is an example of the problem the tour faces. And it's a much more complicated problem to solve, I think, than simply saying, let's go put a 40-second clock. You know, people misunderstand the whole 40-second thing. There is not a 40-second clock until your group is put on the clock. You know, he was not out of position, so he didn't violate any rule by taking all that time. Now, if they had been officially on the clock, then that would have been different. I think there are a lot of causes to what's going on. But, you know, I think there's been such a flurry of conversation and discussion about this that I think the tour is going to have to find a way to do something. I don't expect monumental change, but I think they will find some way to tweak something just to appear like they're taking some action.
Ron Green, Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking Dead Aim. See, I don't think it's all that complicated. I think the PGA Tour, last time I checked, is tripping over piles of money from sponsorship and television. The ends are meeting very well on the PGA Tour. You can't tell me they cannot pay to have reasonable golf people on every hole, not with every group. It doesn't need to be on every group. You need people on every hole to just monitor the progress of each group. And all they need is a two-way radio and common sense. And when they see something going on like DeChambeau, as he walks off the green, they tell him, hey, look, bud, you're not out of position, but you know this isn't right. Speed it up. And then they communicate on the two-way radio to the next hole. The next time that he gets warned for something like that, boom, you're docked 2 strokes. And the second you start affecting strokes and money with those guys, it's amazing how many 3-hour and 55-minute rounds you're going to see on the PGA Tour. It's not a complicated solution. It's a solution that no one wants to implement because someone's going to get dinged and gritch a lot about it. it, and no one wants that. But someone's got to have that happen for anything to be done. Otherwise, it's just lip service.
Yeah, I can't imagine they would go to two-stroke penalties unless it's like your fifth offense or something. I think one stroke is like Armageddon right now, even to talk about that. So, I mean, I think they have to put some teeth into it. I think when you have the best players in the world, McIlroy and Koepka, sort of taking a leadership role to push this agenda and keep it alive, you know, it means that they want to see some activity, some sort of action. You know, the simple fact of the matter is, you put 156 players out there on Thursdays and Fridays, you're not going to play a four-hour round of golf with on those golf courses with threesomes. I mean, 4 hours and 45 minutes is a good time. That's just the golf courses. The greens are too fast, which slows down play, which, of course, club members always want to talk about how fast their greens are. Well, you want to speed up play at your club, slow your greens down, and everybody can putt better, and you'll have a quicker round of golf. You know, there's a lot of talk about range finders. Well, you know, you'll hear some tour players and caddies say range finders will slow play down because we're going to still keep our book. We're going to use a range finder to confirm what we want. I don't know. I talked to somebody here at Pinehurst today about that, somebody who would know. I said, you use them. You've got the data. They said, yes, our data says what the tour players and caddies are saying is not right. We have the data to say it does speed up play a little bit. I think the biggest thing they could do, and other than just, you know, strict enforcement of pace play, is get rid of greens books and get rid of those lines on the ball, the alignment lines. Just, you see guys fidgeting with getting that line just right, and greens books, you know, put some greens information in your yardage book if you need to, but once you get to green, you can't open it up. I mean, that's what got DeChambeau the other day. He said, my book and my eyes didn't match up. So he went back to his book three times on an 8-foot putt. I mean, that's just ridiculous. Just hit it, you know. To paraphrase the old Waylon Jennings song, are you sure Jack did it that away?
Rod Grigier with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking dead aim. Get you out of here on this. Where you are right now is a very special place. In fact, Tom Pashley's coming up right after you on the show. The U.S. Amateur returns to Pinehurst in a unique fashion. You've covered a lot more of these than I have, but I can't remember a U.S. Amateur off the top of my head that took place on multiple golf courses. It just speaks to the championship caliber of number four in addition to number two being put into play this week. And it's just, I don't know, it just seems a little more special when a major championship, and I do consider the U.S. Amateur a major when it comes to Pinehurst.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is a big event for whomever gets it. I mean, last year Pebble Beach, this year Pinehurst, next year Bandon Dunes. I mean, that tells you the, you know, the magnitude of this championship. That's what is it, the 119th or whatever, and to have it here and to have it on number four, I mean, it's that's a great compliment to what Pinehurst and Bob Dedman, Tom Pashy, and all those guys, Eric Hughes, for what they have done to create this down here and to do that with that golf course. Nobody's saying number four is the equal of number two, and the scoring averages down here in the stroke play can point that out. I mean, there was a 4-stroke difference. I mean, the first round scoring average on number two was 77. That's
wow.
I mean, it is a beast. It is fearsome. I mean, guys, you know, talking to Scott Harvey's like, I mean, their shots that just scare you. Just like I can't hit this shot there. You know, if I miss it by a foot, it could be here or there. But I think it's number four is just, you know, it is a new star. I mean, it's a darling in terms of golf design and all that, and aesthetics, and people who are now, they have this other course that really resonates with people. And while number two will forever be what it is, this is, you know, can go shoulder to shoulder, and to play that championship match over both of those, that's just, I think, really, really cool and great compliment to this place, to that golf course. And I mean, it's, you know, this is a great championship, you know, one of the best. I mean, you look at the history, you look at who was playing in it a year ago with the Hovlands and the Wolves and the Morikawas and all that, and suddenly look where they are now. You know, it doesn't get here often, but it is it's just a perfect marriage here with Pinehurst and the Amateur.
From the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, that's Ron Green Jr., and when we return, to the Sand Hills we go as Pinehurst's Tom Pashley takes dead aim at all the enhancements to the properties under his watch. Presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music.
Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos. Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Tom Pashley is the president, visionary leader, and steward of Pinehurst Resorts, cited this weekend's United States Amateur Championship. And I've been looking forward to speaking with him for some time and finally got the chance a couple of weeks ago.
Tom, let me begin with a story that took place, I guess, almost 2 years ago. It was around Christmas time of 2017. My nephew had graduated from Baylor University, and he's a golf fanatic. And I told him, look, you get to the point where you're out of my sister's house, you have a job, you're paying your own rent, and you can afford a plane ticket. As a graduation gift, a weekend at Pinehurst is on me. And he called me in November, and he said, okay, I'm in. I said, you do know it's cold around this time, right? He says, I don't care. Book it. I'm coming to Pinehurst. I said, okay. So this is around the second week in December, maybe the week right before Christmas. And it was sort of an Indian summer weekend. We actually played number two in shorts, I think, on December 18th or 19th. It was fantastic. But anyway, we played number eight. We played, I think, number one, and then we played number two. And right before we left, we had lunch at the Deuce, and then we played on the Cradle. And my son actually had a hole-in-one on the Cradle. And it was a perfect day, and you had that beautiful sort of winter sunset. And as the sun was setting, we're walking towards the car in the parking lot. And I had met you before, so I recognized you from a distance. And right as I was about to say something, you stopped the three of us, and you said, well, boys, how was it? And, of course, they piped up and said it was fantastic. And my son said, you know, I had a hole-in-one. And you immediately said, well, did you get your poker chip? Because if you get a hole-in-one on the Cradle, there's a poker chip with the appropriate hole that you receive as sort of a prize. And he said, yeah. And, you know, I was so taken aback. We were the only people on the sidewalk. There was no reason for you to stop and say a word. And as we made our way to the car, we got in. And I said, guys, do you have any idea who that was? And they said, no. I said, that's the guy who runs the whole joint. I said, that's Mr. Pashley. He's the president here at Pinehurst. I said, all that you see, he is responsible for. And I said, this is how you run a company. This is how you run a business. He didn't have to take the time to acknowledge us or to even know that we were there. I said, and look at what all he did and what all he said. And it took no effort. I said, and you see this at Pinehurst from him down, because this is the example that Mr. Pashley sets. And so I wanted to thank you for that from 2 years ago. Wow. And as I mentioned before we started recording this, I wanted to thank you for the stewardship of Pinehurst.
Well, it's what a great story, and thank you for sharing. I remember that moment now that you've brought it back up. And I guess, Charlie, I would just have to say, you know, it's a privilege that we get to have to share in the daily thrill of being at Pinehurst. And if you ever lose sight of that, I guess it's time to move on. But if you don't, if you can't recognize a group of three people like you with the nephew and your son and try to add to their experience, it's like I say, it's just a real privilege to work at a place that means so much to so many. And while it's steeped in history and tradition, I think there's just so much fun that's being had right now at Pinehurst with the Cradle and with that hole in one. And it's just, like I say, it's so much fun for us to be part of it. And we never lose sight of the fact that this is it could be a trip of a lifetime for someone. It might be their one time that they're going to be here, or it could be a monthly trip. But we always want to make sure that everybody's enjoying it. And I just love it here so much. I've been here 23 years. I love it so much. And I want everybody else to love it as much as I do. And so I try when I can to engage with everybody who's here and just make sure they're having a great time.
You being here as long as you have, you'll understand this next statement. I've had this conversation more than once with our mutual friend, Matt Janella from the Golf Channel. I've talked about that Pinehurst with those of us that love golf and live here in the Carolinas, it is often referred to with the pronouns we and our. You don't get that other places. We take personal possession of Pinehurst. It is a personal source of pride with us. And I think what I have enjoyed most about your stewardship being at Pinehurst is how you've taken that seriously and taken that to the level of, I love this place so much that we can't afford to stand pat. We need to always be looking forward. I know for a fact that you have traveled, and I assume continue to travel, to other comparable golf destinations like Bandon and Streamsong, Cabot. You know the ones I'm talking about. What are specific amenities that when you traveled to those places, before you started to make changes, when you traveled to those places, you said, you know, we can do this, and we should do this, and we can probably do it better at Pinehurst?
Yeah, it is. I love being able to travel and hang out with guys like Matt Ginella and others who enjoy golf travel. And so every place we go on a golf trip, I'm always, you know, eyes wide open, trying to pick up on the service level, the amenities, the golf experience, all that stuff. And so I would say what they've done at Bandon is really remarkable, to create something out of nothing. And so we pay a lot of attention to what they do. They actually saw our first version of a putting course that we call Thistle Dew. It was a smaller version than what we have now. Mm-hmm. They saw what we did there, and then they created the Punch Bowl, which is, you know, five times the size.
And it's an amazing sight if you ever get out there to see it.
And they, you know, but they put in little neat tee markers that are drink holders. And so when we when we redid our Thistle Dew and made it three times the size and put it right by the clubhouse, we adopted those drink holders. So it is, you know, as Matt Ginella would say, the golfer wins. You know, as we're all trying to find ways to improve the golf experience, the winner in all of this is the person who gets to travel and take advantage of it all, because, you know, you can't stand pat. You can't sit still and rest on your laurels, because everybody is always in the middle of the next big thing. It's one of the reasons why we brought Gil Hansen to redo Pinehurst number 4. Here you had a great Tom Fazio golf course that a lot of people said was their favorite course at Pinehurst, but it just was not, you know, in keeping with the overall aesthetic here anymore. And so, again, not wanting to rest on our laurels and not standing still, we brought him in. And it's really exciting now that number 4 is going to get to host some of the world's best players, with the U.S. Amateur returning here in just a few days.
Yeah, there's so much to talk about with you. Tom Pashley's the president at Pinehurst. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. I guess the renovation and restoration of number 2 by Corin Crenshaw was probably the catalyst. It began all the big changes at Pinehurst. And it seems like with each one, there was another, you know, we need this box that was checked. I want to sort of go in order by things that I noticed as a frequent traveler to Pinehurst. Let's start with the deuce. For those of us old timers, we remember that there used to be a separate pro shop for number 2. And that was where what now stands, a fantastic gathering place before or after round, complete with a great bar. If there was a common criticism that I used to hear from people who made the pilgrimage to Pinehurst, it was that, you know, there was no place to just kind of hang out after the round. And I know that the changes to number 2 were made with some skepticism and trepidation from some. Surely there were no objections to getting rid of the number 2 pro shop and creating the deuce, were there?
There were some. You know, the retail folks weren't real happy to lose a retail shop, if you will. But it's one of those things, Charlie. Now, as people have enjoyed it over the last 2 or 3 years, they say, "How did you ever not have this? You
know,
what used to be here? This used to be retail. Why would that? You know, it makes so much sense the way it is now, and it's such a neat setting, and the view is perfect. But that one went through a lot of planning. You know, originally, it was just going to be a small little pub, a place to get a post round drink. And we were going to keep the Donald Ross Grill open for lunch. That was our lunch venue. As we got deeper into the planning, we thought, this is the view, and this is the place to hang out, and this is where people want to be. Let's find ways to and expand it and make the kitchen bigger so that we can serve more meals. But, the Deuce is about 3 years old now, and it really has transformed that – the energy level on that side of the building, right behind the 18th green of number two. When you come up 18 on course two now and it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you've got an audience of 40 or 50 people.
Yeah, as if putting on number two's 18th green wasn't enough. Now you've got to put up with hecklers. We appreciate that.
And it's a neat one of the little traditions we do there, and I don't know if you've had a chance to experience this. If you make a two on any hole on course two, but primarily a par three, if you make a birdie on a par three, you make a two on number two, you come to the deuce, and they give you a special little commemorative coin, much like that poker chip you talked about for the hole in one. But
I have two coins in my golf bag that are used as ball markers right now.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Tom, if I were to point to any of the changes and immediately just say, brilliant, it is the addition of the enlarged Thistledew putting course and the Cradle short course. There are lots of putting courses and short courses out there at some of the resorts that we named earlier. But the playability of both of these, here's what I find remarkable. You don't even have to play golf to have fun. If you're there on a trip and you've got She Who Must Be Obeyed who lives in your home with you, who is not all that into golf, but say a father and son are, she can go to the spa, but then she can meet you for lunch and she can have a great time on the putting course or the short course. It is so expertly designed. It has to have just exceeded all expectations you had.
You nailed it. It has exceeded every expectation we could have ever had. And it just makes it stirs your soul. If you're a golfer, if you love the gathering of people to have fun, you just love to sit out there and watch it. And you nailed it. You don't have to be a golfer to go out there and have fun. On Thistledew, everybody misses a putt by 20 feet.
God can't make any of those putts. What are we talking about here?
Right. So it allows you to just laugh it off and have fun, and the scratch player is going to make a terrible putt, and the beginner is going to make an ace.
Yes.
You know, and so everybody gets to laugh, and there's a sense of community out there because you can see everybody else, even on the Cradle, our 9-hole short course that you mentioned. You see every hole, and you have this sense of you're in a special place, having fun, and I like to say, you know, you wouldn't go to the Vineyard and not try the wine. To come to Pinehurst as a non-golfer, you at least need to roll a ball on the putting course or hit one on the Cradle. It used to be, you know, I would take my kids out on the golf course and you have to shush them or you have to, you know, tell them where to stand or, you know, be here or be there. When you're on Thistledew or the Cradle, you know, cartwheels can happen anywhere. You can be barefoot. You can scream. You can holler. And that's what's been so neat about it. It's open to the public, so anybody can come out and enjoy it. And Gil Hance designed the putting course and the short course. He's a world-class architect, and so he nailed it. He absolutely did a phenomenal job. And I think the location is the thing that makes it so special. You are on the front doorstep of the Pinehurst Resort Clubhouse, and it's a special, special place. And to think that where the Cradle sits used to just be two par fours. Two par fours, and there might have been 8 to 12 people out there at any time. Now you could have 70 people out there playing in eightsomes with music playing on the Cradle with the neat pine cone beverage cart that we have right
there. I am so glad you brought that up. That was the next thing I wanted to say. I spent some time, Tom, with the Disney Imagineers years ago at a conference, the people who dream up the promotions for Disney. And what they would say is they would start with something like, we're going to introduce Spaceship Earth at Epcot. And the next question they would ask was, and then what? Well, let's get some astronauts from the Apollo program. Okay, and then what? And they would continue to have and then what and write these down on a grease board until they ran out of and then what. And then they'd sort of figure out what they wanted to do from there. There was a great idea up there. And I look at the Cradle as, okay, let's build a short course. Okay, and then what? Let's make it playable for everyone. Okay, and then what? Well, let's have it with a sort of a loose and fun atmosphere. Let's pipe in some music on the Cradle. Okay, and then what? Well, you know what's missing is we need some kind of place where somebody can, you know, even though it doesn't even take an hour to play it, you know, let's get some place where we can have some refreshments and sit down. Okay, here's the pine cone. And then what? It's the constant tweaks that make the experience better that I just every time I go to play the cradle, I sort of go, OK, what am I going to see this time that they've done that have made this even better when I didn't think it could be?
Well, I'd never thought that's a great analogy with the Disney Imagineers. And then what? And we'll implement that in some of our strategic planning now. But, yeah, it is layered. And I would tell you, the music, for instance, we piped music in on our grand opening day. And it was a kind of a one-time-only experience. And so many people said how much fun that added to the overall experience. We thought, well, maybe we should have music every day. And again, it's this fine line that we find ourselves walking. Of Pinehurst is a very traditional place and steeped in history, and the statue of Payne Stewart making the winning putt from the 99 Open is only 100 yards away. Yet somehow it works. We have to acknowledge that the game is changing and that you've got to introduce new elements to get new participation. So. But something like the pine cone, my gosh, it sits right on top of the third hole of the cradle. There's Adirondack chairs sitting outside of it. So a lot of people will just go to get a drink and watch people play the cradle because it's such a fun experience and listen to the music. So I would tell you, we're not done. I think that we can find ways to continue to use the cradle to grow the game and to introduce new people to it. And to find ways to do good. So if you've got any other great ideas for us, keep them coming, because I feel we've just scratched the surface with what we can accomplish on the cradle.
Well, I don't know if it's a great idea. I don't know if it's feasible, but I have had it asked of me. Has there been any thought to lighting the cradle for night play?
We get asked that a lot, and we might consider lighting a hole or two. We are here in the beautiful village of Pinehurst, and having something lit up at night isn't necessarily consistent with the laid back lifestyle that we enjoy. So, but it's a question we get asked a lot, and perhaps even the putting course. If we could find a way to light Thistledew so people could just they don't want to leave. They're here having so much fun. And we sit there and wonder, where did these people used to go? Because there really was no reason to stick around. You know, after your round, you would go find something else to do, and now they just continue to stay and enjoy it. Lighting it would continue into the evening hours.
That's Pinehurst Tom Pashley, and up next, he continues to take dead aim at where we are now with Pinehurst Properties and the U.S. Amateur being contested there this weekend. Presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
We're taking dead aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And we continue now with Pinehurst Resort's Tom Pashley.
To accommodate the enlarged Thistledew in the cradle, we already mentioned this, some alterations had to be made. I know number 5 was affected. Were you met with pushback upon plan presentation about altering, I guess it was 5-1 or maybe 5-3, and has all that sort of quieted to non-existence now?
Yeah, it took great creativity from our agronomy team to say, hey, we could find a way to relocate these two par fours. It was the first hole of course 5 and the first hole of course 3. Course 3 is a Donald Ross golf course, so anytime you're touching a Donald Ross golf course, you have some anxiety. But we really did feel like the benefits would outweigh any sacrifice, and we had very little skepticism from the outset, but now that our members and our guests have had the opportunity to play the cradle, it was a great trade-off. We did number 3, course 3 became a par 68 as a result of some of these changes, and you know what, in the end, people you can play it a little faster. Number three is a fun course to play. If you don't want to take four and a half hours, you can get around course three in three and a half hours. So I think there was a little bit of skepticism at first. And like I say, anytime you're touching one of Donald Ross's courses, you want to be very thoughtful about it. But the benefits have far outweighed any of the sacrifices that were made.
Tom, the latest two moves have been, I know, phenomenally received. You've already brought up one, and we'll get into it with more detail when we talk about the amateur in a few minutes. But, you know, I played and I caddied number four many times prior to Hans's renovation. I was stunned at not only how much I didn't recognize the course at all, and I mean, like I said, I knew the golf course, but how much I loved the renovation and did not miss the old course at all. I mean, I dare say I like it even more than I love what's been done to number two, and I love what was done there.
Careful now, Charlie. If you're going to bring number two,
I know. I know. People, no. Look, people look at me and say, who haven't been there. And they say, "Are you high?" And I'm like, "No, I'm totally serious." And maybe it's because I did play it and did caddy on it many times before that I recognize the artisanship and the craftsmanship and just the genius that Hans was able to capture.
Well, and what you said is exactly what we were hoping for, the debate about which is your favorite, because prior to the redo of number four, it was pretty unanimous. Number two, basically because of all of its history and being a Donald Ross masterpiece with those turtleback greens, number two was, you know, the course that everybody enjoyed. Now, they struggle out there because it's a tough test, but it was their favorite. And now with the new number four, you know, number four has a lot more elevation change than number two does. So that gives you a chance for more visual drama. It has a large lake that a couple holes wrap around. So, you know, for golfers who are looking for a little more visual appeal, you get that out on course four. And with that elevation change, you get all these wonderful vistas. We stood on the sixth green, which is a par three on course four. Gil Hans and I and Bob Farron, our agronomy head, stood there, and we could see parts of 15 different holes from that one spot. And that's vistas that you just don't get on course number two. And so, absolutely, it has transformed that land. A lot of people used to say the original version of course four was their favorite, and then it got changed, and then they loved the Tom Fazio version. And we're really hearing from so many people that this version, the Gil Hans version, we hope is going to, you know, stand the test of time. And a subtle thing that neither of us has mentioned yet, but its visual is much more in keeping with the Pinehurst number two visual, the sandy wire grass, pine straw areas. And previously it was much more manicured, had pot bunkers, and it was a little inconsistent with the Sand Hills aesthetic. And so now it feels like a better neighbor and companion to the Pinehurst number two course that it really kind of parallels.
Yeah, I think what I like most is, you know, with Core and Crenshaw, they were able to actually go back and through some great pictures from early on in the early to mid 20th century, see Pinehurst number two in its original form and how it was laid out. And so they sort of had a template to go by. With Hans, not, you know, it was never designed that way. With what Hans did to almost pay an homage to number two, yet maintain, or with number four, but to maintain its playability and even enhance it, was just, that's the genius of it to me, was that he was just able to say, okay, I like what they did there. Now, how do we make that fit in here and blend? And it's seamless. It's fantastic.
And one of the best features of it, he didn't want to try to replicate greens complexes like you have on number two, because those are one of a kind. And so what's, you know, he would refer to the greens on number two as with the turtleback shape, they're a little repellent. You know, the ball is moving away from them unless you hit a perfectly struck shot. On number four, the surrounding land funnels the ball a little more into the greens. So the contours on course four funnel the ball into the greens. Once you're on the green, you've got some challenges to get the ball into the hole, but it's a nice contrast. So it's not a mini number two. It's a very different playable golf course, but also a compliment.
Tom, similar to the complaint that I mentioned earlier about the lack of a hang spot that precipitated the deuce, a similar complaint was the lack of a hang spot at night to watch a game, have some beers, get some good pub food, and then boom, you want to talk about a success story. The Pinehurst Brewing Company, just me saying that, I can see you through the other end of the phone. You're smiling right now, aren't you, Tom?
A big smile. Huge smile.
Talk about exceeding expectations. That place, every time I go, I was there for a practice round before the big father-son tournament with the CGA on a Sunday, and my son and I went to lunch. And then after the father-son tournament on that Friday, we went back there for lunch. And in that span of time, 5 days, all the craft beers had been changed out. And we had two or three other menu items we hadn't had before. And they were equally fantastic. And the vibe in that place is just fantastic.
Well, thank you. It's a great vibe. It's a great old building. You know, history. We're all about history here. And we were able to take this 120-year-old brick building that was the original steam plant.
It was the steam plant, right.
Yeah, it produced power for the village of Pinehurst to power the Holly Inn and all the cottages. And then it kind of was decommissioned 35 years ago. It kind of became just a warehouse of stuff that we've always owned it. It's always been part of the Pinehurst company. But then we decided we wanted to do something special with it. Hired a great brewer out of Charlotte, Eric Mitchell, came from Heist Brewery. And so the beer is fantastic, but then we've got a pit boss. We've got our own smokehouse there, so we're smoking our own brisket and pork and sausages. We cook thin pizzas on this gas-fired oven, and so the beer's great, the food's great, the atmosphere's great. There's some really neat outdoor sitting, a great patio. So, you know, to your point of there used to not be a real place of any sort of scale. They're neat little pubs in the village and places you can go, but here's a place where you can go and 125 people can be part of a night out and in a historic setting. It has been fantastic. We're going on our one-year anniversary. We're making plans for late September. And to your point, the beers are constantly changing. Our brewer just loves, you know, being creative. I can't wait to get down there right now. We've got a coconut lime sour beer that he's just brought out. There's a great Kolsch. I'm learning so much about the beer business. and it's fun. It really is fun.
Before we get to the U.S. Amateur, one final question about what all you've done at Pinehurst and what's coming up. What's next on the project wish list? Obviously, we've shown through this conversation you're not one that likes to stand pat. What's sort of on the horizon for Pinehurst?
Well, the next thing for us, we have three different hotel properties. So the Carolina Hotel is the flagship, our largest hotel.
The single greatest breakfast anywhere in the civilized world is breakfast before you play golf at the Carolina Hotel.
Yeah, indeed. Yes. And then in the heart of the village is the Holly Inn, a smaller hotel, the original hotel, opened in 1895. And then we have a third hotel, which is our smallest, a 43-room hotel, right above the brewery. It's called the Manor. And so the Manor has been going through a one-year complete renovation process, and it's going to reopen here in about 3 weeks. So the end of the month, so in early September, people will begin coming back to the Manor. And it's a really neat hotel. We've taken, you know, the history and the charm of it, but we've given it some modern flair. And so it's positioned for golf groups. We've got neat private rooms, so a group of 4, 8, 12 guys can rent out this private room if they want to have their scoring ceremony there. They want to watch the Final Four. They want to watch the Masters. So we've got two or three different private spaces for people to rent. But it's a modern hotel experience inside a 1920 structure. But it feels like Pinehurst. And so the Manor is going to be the next big thing that we want people to come and experience. And then we just shift into our championship calendar, and which we'll talk about. But the Manor is the next big thing.
Tom Patchley is the president of Pinehurst. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. The relationship with Pinehurst and the United States Golf Association is one that I think has no equal since 99, just off the top of my head here. We've hosted three Opens, a Women's Open. We're about to host the U.S. Amateur. I'm sure I'm missing two or three more. Is that something you take pride in? By that, I mean as the quote-unquote cradle of American golf. You almost feel it's the duty of Pinehurst to be at the forefront of hosting national championships?
Yeah, and indeed, yeah, we've got a great championship tradition with our own championship, the North and South Amateur. Yeah, so we've started that in 1901. The women started in 1903. So championships have been being played at Pinehurst, you know, for well over a century. But to bring the world's best golfers to this area and have them play, you know, Donald Ross's masterpiece that he built in 1907, and it's been challenging, you know, the world's best players. Every decade or so, ever since then, is really special. It used to be for us that, you know, each generation, you know, had a champion at Pinehurst that they could identify with. So you go back to the '99 Open, and you had Payne Stewart, and then Michael Campbell won in 2005. And in 14, we had Martin Keimer and Michelle Wee. The U.S. Amateur in 08 was won by Danny Lee, who's now on the PGA Tour. So it's really neat to just cycle through, you know, a different generation of the world's best players once a decade or so. And so I go back and look at the last U.S. Amateur that we had, Charlie. We had in 2008, Ricky Fowler was in that field, Patrick Reed was in the field, Johnny Vegas, Billy Horschel, Chesson Hadley, Wesley Bryan. So when the Amateur is played here in just a few days, we're going to be looking at the next, you know, legendary golfers who are going to be playing on national television. And so we get a chance to walk behind them without any ropes, you know, to walk the fairways and watch them play. And it's really special.
In 2014, you already brought this up, you hosted the men's and women's opens back to back. Looking back on that experiment, how did it go? And do you think we're likely to ever see someone attempt that again?
It was funny you mentioned experiment. It really was a risk, if you will, on the USGA's part. They're the ones. We should gladly said yes when they brought the idea to us, and they viewed it as a great opportunity to celebrate, you know, championship golf at the highest level and to be able to watch the world's greatest women play right after the world's greatest men played and see the different types of styles of shots that they hit in and the scores that they shoot. There were a lot of things that could have happened. You know, there were concerns about where would crosswalks be for spectators, and would the women be hitting out of divots left over from the men? Would the greens survive 2 weeks of championship conditions? Big challenge. It was what if you have a playoff? Back then, the USGA was still doing
it. Was 18-hole playoff.
An 18-hole playoff, so the women wouldn't be able to start on time. And all those question marks, it was a grand slam of a success. And the men finished on Sunday. The golf course was in phenomenal condition, so the greens were as healthy for the second week as they were for the first week. You ended up with Michelle Wee winning the second week, her first major. And so what turned out is what could have, you know, had a lot of challenges turned into a grand slam home run. And will it ever be done again? I don't know. They felt like Pinehurst was a unique venue to do it, mm-hmm. because we don't have manicured rough. You don't have to grow rough up to 3 inches, and the club head speed of the women isn't as high as the men, and so you wouldn't have a chance to mow the rough down. So I don't know that it will ever happen again, but if they'd like to give it another try, we'd be more than happy to host it here.
Tom Patchley's the president of Pinehurst, our guest taking Dead Aim. One of the particular aspects of this U.S. Amateur that I find very interesting is that the 36-hole medal play portion of the championship will be contested on number 4, with the match play then moving to number 2. I don't know how unique it is for the entire championship to be contested over 2 different courses, but I don't think it happens very often, if ever. Was this something that the USGA had to be sold on, or was it their idea?
It was a mutual. We collaborate with them, and we've got a great relationship, great partnership with the USGA. So when the plan was made to restore or to redesign the 4th golf course, Pinehurst number 4, in the back of our minds, we were hopeful that they might like it enough to move the stroke play qualifying onto it. As we got further and further along, and as they saw the golf course and knew that it would be a championship-worthy test, we began talking about the 36-hole finals. So at the 36-hole, you're down to 2 players. You start with 312. You have a cut, 64, make it to match play. On the last day, the final 2 competitors play 36 holes, and we thought it would be really special if the morning round could be on course 4 and the afternoon round on course 2. It had never been done before. But again, they first and foremost, the golf course has to be championship caliber, and they saw what they saw in number four. They liked, and they also liked the wrinkle that it might put in a player's mind. If you know that you play number two really well, but you struggled on course four, there's just a little more mental baggage that you have to deal with, which is all golfers need. You just need a little one screw loose to begin the whole thing to unravel. So they liked the fact that it is presenting a new challenge to the players. And again, we love things that have never been done before, like the back-to-back opens and to contest the 36-hole final match on two different golf courses, never been done before. We're really excited about. So it's going to be really special. It'll be on you know, national television on Sunday. So we can't wait for things to happen next week and to see how it all unfolds.
Then there's people like me that pray as hard from the tips on number six on number four as I do from the tips on number 17 on number two. They're both par threes. They both require help from the Almighty that I do not have. People don't realize, or maybe they do, on Pinehurst proper, where, you know, you have courses one through five, you have the Cradle, you have Thistledew. Where is the infrastructure this time going to go with this tournament? Are we going to see the massive tents that we normally do with USGA championships, or is it a smaller infrastructure situation with the amateur?
Yeah, well, it is a smaller infrastructure. While the field is larger, you know, you got 312 players versus 156. You've got a larger field, a lot more to see, but it doesn't come with all the hospitality venues and the number of volunteers required is much smaller. So what most people, a lot of people say the U.S. Amateur is their favorite USGA championship because it is a much more intimate championship. And so I mentioned earlier that you have the opportunity to walk the fairways with the players. You stay a respectful distance away, but you'll hear, you know, conversations between caddy and player about yardages and wind direction. And so it is, for people who love championship golf, this is one of the more unique opportunities to walk the fairways and not have, you know, not have a 20-minute shuttle ride from the remote parking lot to be able to get a lot closer to the action and to be part of it. So, yeah, it's a national championship, don't get me wrong, but it doesn't have all of the scale that comes along with something like the U.S. Open.
Will there still be tourist play at other resort sites during the amateur week, or is the whole resort kind of shut down and focused on the amateur?
There will still be play being had on courses 6, 7, and 8, and 9. I think even courses 3 and 5, which start on the other side of Highway 5, mm-hmm. they'll remain open. So, but at the main core, anything that's going to be, you know, right around course number 2 or course number 4, those will be closed.
Get you out of here on this. Tom Pashley's the president at Pinehurst, our guest taking Dead Aim. In terms of hosting USGA events going forward, and, you know, even at this point, do you approach them or do they approach you, or is there just a constant dialogue of let's look at the calendar and see what we can make happen?
Yeah, it is a constant dialogue at this point. Having hosted 3 U.S. Opens and they've done numerous women's opens down the road at Pine Needles, they love this area. They love the support that they get from the state of North Carolina, both from a corporate standpoint and from a volunteer standpoint, from a governmental standpoint. The state of North Carolina embraces them when they come here, so they want to continue coming back. The U.S. Open returns in 2024, so it's nice to have another U.S. Open championship on the books already. And it is just kind of a constant dialogue about let's continue to look at our calendars and see how things evolve. I know they're coming back for the Women's Open in 2021, I believe, or 22. So believe it or not, you know, their U.S. Open office is in the village of Pinehurst. So the people who run the day-to-day operations of the U.S. Open championship reside in the village of Pinehurst and travel. So it's a great relationship, and you know, it's not a question of if, but when. It will return.
Look, we are blessed in the Carolinas to have such access to Pinehurst, and doubly blessed that its leader and true steward is that man, Tom Pashley. I'd also like to thank Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer for his time and insight this week. A reminder, should you just be catching the last little bit of the show, wonder what all we've covered today, no worries. Just subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, BPod Studios, Spotify, all the usual podcast outlets, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice. Additionally, a great source of constant golf updates is our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. Featured there now, links to articles on the latest goings-on in and around the game. And weather-wise, well, it's going to be hot. I mean, really hot. But perfect in the Carolinas to tee it up and let this game continue to haunt your soul and break your heart. And if you do put a peg in the ground, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep it in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT underscore golf guy. And I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim. Presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.